Welcome back to the Arts Hour on the BBC World Service with me, Nikki Beatty. If you've only just joined us, listen back online later because you've just missed actor Eddie Redmayne describing his gruelling preparation for his role as the wheelchair-bound genius Professor Stephen Hawking in new film The Theory of Everything. An exploration of the Hungrylists in 1960s Calcutta, India. They even inspired American beat writer Allen Ginsberg on the banks of a river. And conscious hip-hop. Seattle duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis won Grammys and spoke out for the gay world. The two don't usually go together in the rap universe. Coming up in this half of the programme, Hollywood star Michael Keaton on the agony and ecstasy of making his new film, Birdman. In my humble opinion, the most innovative film of the last few years.
Well, you think you get it, then you start to make it, and then you realize how difficult this might be and the challenge, and it becomes frightening, and then once you get past the frightening stage, it becomes possibly exhilarating. And then to see it work is, wow, really exhilarating.
We'll hear about the great violin robbery. Yep, really, the Lipinski Stradivarius. And a tribute to the late, great Neapolitan singer, Pino Daniele. First, though, a formidable and fabulous film female. Gurinder Chadha is the acclaimed British-Asian film director who made Baji on the Beach back in 1993 and has since specialised in looking at Asian or other communities rubbing along or clashing with a larger dominant culture. Her What's Cooking saw four different ethnic families coming together for Thanksgiving in Los Angeles. Bride and Prejudice was Gurinder's Indian take on Jane Austen. But let's face it, we all know her as the woman who brought us the heartwarming, life-affirming 2002 movie Bend It Like Beckham. The film tells the story of a Punjabi teenage girl who wants to play football for England. And now, in what will probably be one of the big UK showbiz stories of 2015, the film has been turned into a West End stage musical. Gurinder Chadha came into the BBC and, in front of a live audience, Libby Purvis began by asking her how she feels about her foray into musicals.
Oh, it's very exciting. One of my earliest memories is going to see The Sound of Music in the cinema in Southall and loving it so much that we hid in the toilets, my sister and I, and stayed and watched it all over again at the next show. And I think music is very important to my psyche, but what I've been able to do with the Bend It Like Beckham musical is combine my love of music with my storytelling skills and also, I hope, you know, with my bigger vision, which was really indeed the film's vision, to talk about England, you know, my love of England, the England that I know and cherish. Making this musical 12 years on since the film came out, I was able to sort of go back and look at why was the film so successful, because at the time it was impossible to get the film made. I mean, it took me 3-4 years to try and raise the money to make the film because everyone kept saying no one wants to see a film about an Indian girl who can bend a ball like David Beckham. So, of course, once the film came out and it was a big hit, you know, I was, you know, pleased, but I was surprised at how stratospheric it became. And to this day, it's still the only film that has been released in every country in the world, including North Korea. it was.
It was this joyfully feel-good film, in spite of the conflict between the parents' immigrant culture and the heroine wanting her freedom and the football. Does your own background reflect this? Was there conflict and resolution while you were growing up?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, everything as a director, I think what you do is you make your own stories, you know, over and over again through different characters. And this is undoubtedly my father and myself, really, and my growing up wanting to do things differently and refusing to learn how to cook chapatis because I knew I would be put into a sort of bracket of nice, you know, girl to marry at some
And you still not cook chapatis?
No, I buy them ready-made, yeah. But I sort of have a kind of a block against doing that sort of thing.
Was it a painful time, though? I mean, that rebelling against your parents? Because it's quite hard for children.
Well, it's interesting because the film is called Bend It, like Beckham, for a reason, because what I was trying to show is that those of us who grow up you know, biculturally, bilingually, or whatever, or multiculturally, in the case of Britain, you know, we don't sort of go around going, oh, my God, I have to rebel against this side to be this side, or I have to rebel against this to be this side. What we do is we find ourselves blending, you know, between, you know, our Englishness and our Indianness, and we do that with music, we do that with comedy. You know, there are things that I find very funny, you know, about Milton and his gags, and there'll be things I find very funny about Punjabi comedians as well. For people who are monolingual and monocultural, I think they find it very hard to appreciate the fact that one can traverse different cultures and languages without there being a sense of rebellion in it and breaking rules. And so what we do is we bend the rules.
Your composer, Howard Goodall, on the musical of Bend It Like Beckham, I gather he's... You've got Charles Hart as a lyric writer, I should say, as well. But I gather there's going to be a mixture of Bangra music and Western music and football songs. You managed to get some football chants in as well.
There's something very elegant about the training of football when you train.
Not down Lake Norient, there isn't. Elegance is not the word that would spring to mind.
What about Grindel? I mean, at the moment, we also know of darker conflicts than football going on all the time in Asian communities as the new generation rises, notably for forced marriages or just huge emotional pressure for an arranged marriage. And are you going to deal with that at all in the musical, or is football just a metaphor for everything that a girl might want and a family might not?
For me, it's about having young women and their families come and experience a show where a girl gets to have it all. You know, the empowerment message for young women is incredibly emotional in the film because you realise how rare it is in our culture and our society for a girl to be able to say, I want to do this, I want to do it this way, why can't I do it? And people around her finally say, you know what, you deserve it. You should be able to do it. Go on, go for it.
Gurinder Chadha there, and I shall report back as soon as I've seen the musical. I'm fascinated by how anyone will choreograph all singing and all dancing football moves and manoeuvres live on stage. Music now, and an appreciation for one of Italy's most famous singer-songwriters, Pino Daniele, who died at the age of 59 on January the 4th. La mente lucida, cuore fuggì. Daniele was from the city of Naples, a place which inspired so much of his music. I spoke to Irena Caselli, our Arts Hour girl in Buenos Aires. She has a somewhat personal connection to the late great singer-songwriter, and I began by asking her what it was.
Yes, I'm from Naples myself, and Pino Daniele was huge in my life. I grew up listening to him in the 1980s, and in the 80s, I think it meant a lot to me hearing him sing in Neapolitan and mix it with some Italian, some English, because Naples received at the time, and it still does receive, a lot of negative publicity. And when I heard him and when I hear him sing in Neapolitan with such depth about what the city is and what it means, I feel very proud of being Neapolitan. And I think that very few people have managed to express musically the good, the bad, and the ugly of the city. And I think loads of people feel like I do, especially in Naples, where a day after his death, there was a last-minute flash mob, and 100,000 people showed up in the largest city of Naples, in Piazza Plebiscito, and sang together his song. It was actually quite an extraordinary event, and I think people were feeling so much his death that a lot of pressure was put on his family to have a second funeral in Naples as well, because his official funeral was held in Rome.
Well, it's appropriate then that to illustrate not only what he sounded like, but also all the things that you've just mentioned that are so important, the issues that affected Naples, mafia, poverty. This song encapsulates all of it. Tell me what it's called.
It's called Napule, which in Neapolitan means Naples is. Napule adore mate. says, Naples is a thousand colors. Naples is a thousand fears. Naples is the voice of children that rises slowly, and you know you're not alone. It says, Naples is a dirty paper and nobody cares. And this is part of that criticism that Pino Daniele managed to voice.
Now, we just heard that version with Eric Clapton, but Eric Clapton wasn't the only big musician that Pino collaborated with, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was very versatile and liked to experiment with other artists. So he also played with Richie Havens and with Pat Metheny, the jazz guitarist. And he was also involved with other artists in Italy, not only musicians, but also actors. And most famously, he was good friends with Massimo Troisi, the director and actor who starred in Il Postino, The Postman. Troisi was also Neapolitan, and the anecdote goes that whenever Pino Daniele had a new song, he would call up Troisi and say, hey, can you write a film around this? And so one song was Quando, that he wrote in the early 1990s, and then became the soundtrack of Pensavo Fosse Amore Invece Era Un Calesse, which is one of Troisi's films.
And Irena, apart from the lyrics that we hear, what's different musically about what Pino Daniele did?
Well, he was, in a sense, quite revolutionary because, I mean, besides his voice that many say has got the attribute of an African-American bluesman, he mixed genres that weren't so famous in Italy, probably, such as blues, jazz, and even rock. But then he managed to mix those with sort of African beats and some Neapolitan folklore.
That was Quando from the film Pensavo Fosse Amore. Thank you to Irena Caselli for that appreciation of the life and work of the late Neapolitan musician Pino Daniele, who died on January the 4th. Now on the Arts Hour, a story about one of the world's greatest musical instruments. Last year, the Lipinski Stradivarius made news headlines when it was stolen in a violent robbery. If we look back, it already had a turbulent history. Peter Curran tells us all about the violin in a documentary, and he begins here by talking about its first owner, the composer Giuseppe Tartini.
The devil opened up his case and he said, I'll start this show, and fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow.
In the 1970s, the Charlie Daniels Band told of a brilliant violin player being visited by the devil. Not the first time Satan had let a musician know that he had the best tunes. Giuseppe Tartini, the great Italian composer and violinist, who was the first owner of this Stradivarius, was visited by Satan in a dream. There are lots of rather frightening paintings of this scene as the devil played a fiendishly, difficult but beautiful piece of music to Tartini. And when the composer awoke with a start, he furiously began composing what became known as his best work, the Devil's Trill Sonata. It was one of Tartini's former pupils, the great Signor Salvini, who passed the violin on to its next owner, the person who would give this Strad the name we know it by today. Karol Lipinski was a brilliant young Polish violinist, only too delighted to have a private audition with Salvini.
Signor Salvini says, give me your violin.
Toby Faber.
He hands over his violin and Salvini smashes the violin on the table beside him into a million fragments, I think is what Lipinski says, and then turns round, picks up a violin and says, now, try this violin. And the violin he is talking about is the violin we now call the Lipinski. Salvini tells him that this is a Stradivarius violin from 1715, which was passed on to him by Tartini. So that is what gives us the provenance for this violin that takes it back from Lipinski through Salvini back to Tartini.
And after passing through various collections, the Lipinski travelled to Cuba, then Germany, and finally ended up in Milwaukee, America, where it was loaned to the city's symphony orchestra concertmaster, Frank Almond. That armed robbery in January last year brought it to prominence again.
So, and I was parked right there. And right here was this van backed in. But it was running. And I was starting to put my violin here, and out of my peripheral vision, there was somebody walking around the front of the van. I remember turning back this way. And the guy was getting closer and closer and closer, and he had on a big fur coat and a big fur hat, and it was very dark back here. There's not a lot of lighting out here. Saw these little flashing lights, and I was wondering why he was trying to take my picture or something. Is it, I thought, and then I realized it was a taser. It wasn't a camera.
What did you feel?
Electrocuted really badly. You know, it's like 50,000 volts with... I mean, it's a very effective weapon. So I fell here, and it was about 7 below, and there was ice everywhere. I knew what had happened, and he just grabbed the violin and got in the van and bolted off. By the time I got up, I saw the van going zooming around the corner, and I was predictably hysterical, and I knew Todd was still here because his car was still there, and he ended up running over, and we were trying to call 911 and just get somebody out here.
They just had an armed robbery. The actor is a black male, 6 feet tall, thin build, fur hat, and the caller did state that he was tased.
There was a taser barb sticking out of my jacket and one stuck in my wrist right there. I was like bleeding on my shoes and had these strings hanging off of me. And the whole thing was just like, what? You know, I mean, those guys took your violin and shot you. It was none of, you know, we just couldn't believe it.
You must have thought your life was over as you kind of got to your feet.
Crazy. It was not a great feeling, I can tell you that.
Thanks to police and forensics experts, the Lipinski was found and returned to Frank Almond. But he says the experience has changed him.
Okay. So here it is.
Oh my goodness.
It's very humbling to play an instrument like this when you know that there are documented concerts with Lipinski playing Beethoven sonatas with Franz Liszt at the piano, you know?
Does it throw up pictures in your imagination, or is it just the music?
That's a tough question. I think I would drive myself crazy if every time I played the Devil's Trill Sonata, I thought about Tartini playing that piece on this violin. I mean, you could just go nuts. The biggest emotion I would feel is a sense of humility. You know, there's a lot of mixed emotion about it because this guy had planned it for what appeared to be several years. This person had apparently become obsessed with stealing one. He was just going to do it and spent years and knew where I lived and he knew my car and he knew some of my routines and he knew the names of my kids. And when somebody tells you that, then you look at everything a little bit differently.
Frank Almond there and Peter Curran. And as always, if you want to hear that whole programme, head to our website, bbcworldservice.com/artshour. I remember when I lost my mind. Finally on today's Arts Hour, a film I've been dying to talk about, Birdman, written, produced and directed by the maverick Mexican auteur Alejandro González Iñárritu. I love his work. I'll just rewind slightly so that my enthusiasm can be appropriately placed for you. In 2000, I saw his first feature film, Amores Perros, and was utterly blown away. He turned the usual linear narrative on its head. Then he made 21 Grams, similarly interweaving many storylines and starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. He then brought us Babel and Beautiful, and every one of those features got Oscar nominations, by the way. And now we have Birdman. It's a black comedy starring Michael Keaton as Regan Thompson, a middle-aged actor mounting an off-Broadway stage production. The play is Regan's bid for a comeback, as he's associated with one screen role, the superhero Birdman, a character that refuses to leave him. As Michael Keaton arguably reinvented the comic hero genre with his troubled Batman in Tim Burton's 1989 film and its sequels, it's tempting to find parallels between Keaton's own history and the character he plays here. But when Francine Stock met him, he was emphatic that the comparisons end there.
You know, I really admire what Regan Thompson did. It took a lot of courage. And he's also extremely pathetic and, to me, disgustingly needy, and I don't get that. I'm not built like that. I had done a fair amount of things, and I was known for some things before that and after, so I wasn't burdened. He was known primarily for that, even though he had done other things and, you know, some successful things. That was really his thing. It was a white-hot spotlight on this guy, and he unfortunately let it become a burden to him, and understandably to some degree, you know. I get how that could happen. What burden did I have? I was fortunate enough to play Batman. That's pretty cool.
You're doing this because you're scared to death, like the rest of us, that you don't matter. And you know what? You're right. You don't. It's not important, okay? You're not important. Get used to it.
Obviously, the headline in some ways about this is the way that it was made with these very long takes. Mm. And what was your initial thought when you saw the script and you saw that this would be the way that it would be done?
Well, you think you get it, then you start to make it, and then you realize how difficult this might be and the challenge, and it becomes frightening. And then once you get past the frightening stage, it becomes possibly exhilarating to see if you can do it. And then to see it work is, wow, really exhilarating.
Yeah, are you at all afraid that people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up superhero?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off!
Thank you, everybody.
You do have the mask off!
Thank you for coming out. Thank you. We're expecting some great pieces.
No one has the luxury of multiple takes, multiple camera angles. You get one shot at it. You had to be word perfect, you had to be off script, it had to be choreographed down to a question of feet, if not inches sometimes, so that you were in the correct spot at the correct time to hit your cue.
Okay.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play, kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Never mind.
He gets into a bar and I have to turn around and come back and get back into frame and enter. And it would go on and on and on and on like that for long, 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 long scenes.
Because sorry to interrupt you.
No, okay. I'm sorry to be so long, but you asked, and that's the only way you can explain this.
But it isn't just a question of hitting the mark and interacting with the other actors. It's also because the register of the character and the performance shifts so much within these takes. And also sometimes you're in close-up and sometimes there's action. And all of those things have to be remembered too.
Yes. The movie can't be made without intense rehearsal. We only had the access to the theater for X amount of days. And so what happened was Alejandro went to the theater that we were going to use, measured out everything, all the rooms, the stage, where he thought the sets that were not built yet would be, all right? They then came back to a sound stage in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, where they took those measurements and then on an open sound stage floor, taped out everything.
We don't have an actor. Uh-huh. And if we cancel the first preview, the press is going to smell blood. And we can't afford to lose any more money at all.
Okay. What do you think I should do?
Well, we hired an understudy. Let's use the understudy.
No.
Regan, listen to me. Please, for the love of God, listen. Our perfect dream actor is not going to knock on that door and go, hey, fellas, when do I start? You know?
And we proceeded to then, you know, pretend like you're walking down steps and you're turning the corner and he'd say, okay, there's a hallway here. And then when you get down there, you go into this room. And this is where the dressing room is for so-and-so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And while that was done, a replica of the entire backstage is being built to those specifications in New York. When I think about it, Jesus, this is unbelievably overwhelming. And we kind of shot the movie three times.
Can I talk to you for a second?
Yeah, what's up?
Did you find another actor?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Mike's available.
He is?
Mm-hmm. Mike who?
I thought he was doing the thing.
He was. He quit. Or got fired.
Mike who? Which is it, quit or fired?
Well, with the Mike, it's usually both.
I still don't know how we did it, how Alejandro did it. Also, it was a shot out of sequence, shot out of order. So he had to know where, not just where the cuts would be, where the scenes would be, how he would edit it in his mind. You have to know in a movie where you want the audience to be emotionally at that point, where the character should be, you know, all the peaks and then the little drops and the valleys, and then a pace of a movie. You know, a movie has just a certain pace and rhythm. You have to gut feel that and hope that you're right at every point in the film. I don't know how that's even possible.
Michael Keaton's Birdman is in a cinema near you now. See it. Thank you for your company on this week's Arts Hour. And don't forget, you can be in touch with me and the show via Twitter at BBC Arts Hour. And details and information about this week's show are on the website, bbcworldservice.com/artshour. For now, from me, Nikki Beatty, and producer Jean DiMarino, see you next week.